The purpose of Hebrews is really to realign the thinking of Jewish Christians or people from a Jewish background who'd become Christians but who are still kind of inclined to hang on to the past. Are you the sort of person who likes to hang on to the past? Come on, let's confess. A lot of us like to hang on to the old ways, don't we? That seems to be very much part of human psychology, doesn't it? We don't like the unknown, we don't like change, we want to hold on to the past. And in a way, they had a good reason for doing so. They could argue their case, because after all, the God that they worshipped in through the Old Testament was an unchanging God. But as Christ came, they had to make a big move in their thinking. They had to realize that the Old Testament had now been fulfilled. All the laws and ceremonies and rituals that had been such a part of their history, their culture, their way of life, that was now fulfilled and redundant, if we can use that word, because they had entered the era of better things. If you want a key to unlock the letter to the Hebrews, it was the letter of better things. So you get to the first chapter is Christ better than the angels. Then the next part, Christ better than Moses. So great events and characters and people from the past. Jesus is better. Christ greater than the high priest. Wow, that was something. I mean, he was really revered. Christ better than the tabernacle. Christ better than the sacrifices. And so on. And the letter proceeds along those lines to convince these ex-Jewish Christians that they needed to be distinctively Christian Christians. He's not telling them to leave their families or anything like that, but he's saying as far as their relationship with God is concerned, they need to move on and realize that everything is now fulfilled and complete in Christ. So it contains a sort of exhortations, calls to change, as well as information to sort of back up the reasons for that change. So we'll read a few verses from chapter 13, and we'll pick up verse 8. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Do not be led away by diverse and strange teachings, for it is good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, and not by foods which have not benefited those who were devoted to them. The foods there is not your breakfast and your lunch and your tea. It's ritually produced or prepared foods, foods that were to do with their worship in the Old Testament. And they were only of limited benefit. They couldn't really fulfill the purpose of God to bring people into a living relationship with him. We do have an altar, so he goes on verse 10, from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat. What he's saying there is that if you want to be a Jew, you stay with it. But we've got something better, and we're moving on. So those who serve the tent are the old gang. We are moving on and we've found something better. We have an altar and we have a food which is greater than anything that they'd known before. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek that city which is to come. Through him, then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. Do not neglect to do good, and share what you have, for with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. We're going to come to a text there in a few moments. First of all, we'll pray. So Hebrews chapter 13, and I'll read verse 11 to 13 again. The bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate, that is the city gate, Jerusalem, in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek one that is to come. The reason I changed the sermon was because of what happened yesterday afternoon. Jean and I went to visit Pioneer Camp. And it was very evident from the word go that we were only visitors. Because as soon as we got there, the first thing somebody said was, you have to go to the registration tent and sign in. All right. Where's that? Over there in the field. Because of health and safety and safeguarding and all that. Right. So we wander across slightly nervously, wondering if we were going to be grabbed by anybody, got to this registration tent. And there was this very official lady, who was very nice, but she was very official. She had a big folder with all sorts of pieces of paper. We had to start putting our names and addresses and promise that we hadn't been convicted of any awful crime in the last, 5 years and things like that. And then we had to be decked out in red lanyards with a tag on with a number on it. Almost like criminals. I was number 25 and I got clearance to walk around the camp. And you don't feel very relaxed really in that context, do you? You don't feel, oh, here's a big welcome, here's a nice cup of tea and so on. We got the cup of tea later, but only once we got our lanyards on to show that we were bona fide visitors and we weren't coming to do awful things, We were definitely outsiders. And there was a certain amount of kind of security and, as we call it, red tape. In fact, the lanyards that visitors wore were a different colour to campers. So we were second-class citizens from the word go. And in fact, they were red. So that amplified the red tape bit. But it got me thinking. As soon as I came home, I thought, that was a strange experience. I can understand why I have to do it now. We didn't, years ago, we never did any of that, and we were probably wrong, but we didn't do that. So it also felt a bit intense. But it got me thinking about this text. You see, it doesn't feel great to be an outsider, does it? And here, we are told that Christians are outsiders. And we're told that we're outsiders because we identify with Jesus Christ, who himself was the ultimate outsider. I just want to talk to you a little bit about that this evening. One of the things about being a human being is that we all need to feel included. We need to feel we belong. We need a place. We were designed for fellowship, for community, for family, for being welcome with our fellow human beings, but ultimately, of course, with God himself. Our true identity is in relationship. Human beings are uniquely designed for relationship. Now, I know there's a few animals and birds that mate for life. You get swans and things like that, and I think possibly owls, but other animals. But on the whole, it's human beings who are communal. And that's because we have an identity which is rooted in God himself, who is a relational being. Remember, God is a Trinity. He always has been. There was never a time when God was lonely or isolated. He always existed in a context of relationship, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in a profoundly loving and satisfying relationship. And being made in God's image, something of that quality is being downloaded into our hearts as well. And so when you become an outsider, it's quite hard to take. When you feel rejected or kind of downgraded in the sense of becoming inferior, and I think there are a lot of implications in this for Christians today, because we hear an awful lot about people in our culture feeling unwelcome. Now, I know it's become very extreme, and everybody's a victim, and everybody's finding a reason to have a whinge, but there are people who are genuinely feeling isolated, rejected or second class or unwelcome in society for all kinds of reasons. Some of them, of course, are racial. Some of them are to do with poverty. Some of them to do with just inability to kind of build relationships confidently and so on. And I think Christians have got to be ahead of the game on that. But that's challenging, isn't it? Because naturally we feel we like to keep things safe, don't we? So welcoming outsiders is part of being a Christian. And I think that probably applies to Christians such as Tim and Francis, who are ministering to a Ukrainian family. But it applies in lots of other ways as well, perhaps less kind of noticeable almost. Because human beings need relationship and they need community, don't they? And to be an outsider is a painful experience. And the first thing I want to say is that Christ himself was an outsider from the beginning. He was an outsider from the moment of his birth, wasn't he? He was an outsider because he had come from another place. We'll come to that in a moment. But he was an outsider in that he wasn't even welcome in the town of his birth, was he? It wasn't very long before Herod was on the case. He heard that there was another king. And he was very, very edgy about it all, wasn't he? He wanted to cover his back. And so he took drastic steps to eliminate Jesus. So from the word go, Christ was a reject. He was an outsider. He was a persona non grata, as we say. And that's quite a disturbing thought, isn't it? That's what God chose to be. God himself, who had been in eternal, harmonious, secure relationship within himself, moved out of his comfort zone in the highest possible sense and became vulnerable. And that was so right from the word of Jesus, right from the moment of Jesus' birth, wasn't it? He was an outsider. But that didn't diminish his greatness in any way, did it? Remember, he was very open about who he was. He said, I came from the Father. When Jesus came to this world, something of heaven came with him, didn't it? And, of course, the world prefers to keep heaven out, doesn't it? As soon as a Christian starts to talk about their faith, in most company, they feel the vibe, don't they? Oh, this person's been a bit weird, you know. There's always a price to pay, isn't there? As soon as anything of heaven begins to break into this world, people get edgy, don't they? And they certainly did with the coming of Jesus. So Christ was not welcome. It says in John, it says, he came to his own, but his own received him not. He didn't get the welcome he deserved, did he? Despite his miracles, which were only expressions of goodness, his own received him not. It's interesting today, isn't it? Many good people in society are being, well, they use the expression no-platformed, don't they? Or we live in this cancel culture. Often people who will stand out against the tide of secular, I suppose we could say, maybe neo-Marxist opinion, the way that our culture is going, people are very quickly struck off if they dare to stand against it. So even people who are not Christians by any stretch of the imagination, if they raise even a question about the way that the BBC, for example, are promoting LGBT behaviours and so on, they're immediately cancelled. They oh, we won't invite them on again. They might rock the boat. And the people who go on the lecture circuit into the universities are immediately struck off if they say anything that doesn't absolutely 100% endorse and approve the cultural pattern of the day. But it isn't new, is it? It began really with the prophets of God, didn't it? Think how many of the prophets were rejected. Jeremiah was known as the weeping prophet because he had such a hard time. Elijah, what was the verdict on him? Ahab wanted to get rid of him, didn't he? And which was it, Ahab, who said about Micaiah the prophet? He said, I don't like him because he never says anything good about me. He doesn't prophesy good things. But he told the truth. But people who tell the truth are often not welcome. And it's more an indication of the world than the truth itself or the message. So Jesus was an outsider. He said to Nicodemus in John chapter 3, he said, men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds are evil. When did Jesus become the ultimate outsider? Well, it was on that day that they led him outside the city to execute him, wasn't it? That was when it came to a climax. He who had been despised and rejected of men, and who was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, faced the ultimate grief of the abuse and pain of the cross. So that's the first thing. Jesus was an outsider, and he suffered outside the camp. So if you ever visit a camp and you have to go through all that, that we did, maybe you'll just be reminded of that point. Secondly, Jesus Christ came as a fulfillment of the Old Testament. That's really what this letter is all about, is to show that the Old Testament, in all its variety, in all its richness, in all its pointedness, and the way it stood out, or Old Testament religion stood out from all the pagan religions of the day, great as it was not permanent. It was not meant to last forever. It is fulfilled in Christ. And ultimately, of course, it was fulfilled when Jesus went to the cross. Because most of the Old Testament laws kind of are in some way connected with the conquest of sin. There is this power in the world called sin, which has to be dealt with. And Jesus came on that mission. And so when Jesus came to the world and ultimately died on the cross, it wasn't the Jewish conspirators who decided his fate. It wasn't the Roman governor who decided his fate. He wasn't a victim of circumstances or a plan that went wrong and got out of hand. And none of that. It was all part of this long, long journey through history in which God would one day come to the world to redeem lost humanity, because he was the only one who could do it. When you think of all the efforts to try and clean up the human race, and all the efforts to go on today to try and make it a better place, we're on a losing wicket, aren't we? And now the planet's against us as well. And unless God somehow gets involved, we've had it. But God did get involved. And he did come. And he came to fulfill the promises made to our forefathers in the Old Testament period. And if you read the Bible carefully, it's not, it's really all about that, isn't it? It's a preparation for the coming of God himself. It reminds us that history is moving forward. But the difference between Christian thinking and, say, Eastern thinking, you know, Hindu and Buddhist thinking, is that history is not just a long, a never-ending sort of circle of birth, life, death, reincarnation, birth, life, death, reincarnation. That's the Eastern mystic view. Christianity says that there is a line that began at creation. There are stages along the line of the journey, if you like, this timeline, critical moments, when God did certain things which showed that he was on the case, that history is his story, unfolding at his rate as his plan. And ultimately it comes to this moment when God himself steps into the world to carry out this rescue mission. And the covenant with Abraham was all part of that pattern, or that journey that was being mapped out through the Old Testament. And the letter to the Hebrews carries really a message of preparation, doesn't it? Or it shows that the Old Testament period was a preparation for this one day coming king, the ultimate, the one who would fulfill all the great sort of acts of God in the past. So, Jesus comes then to fulfill the Old Testament. And that's why the letter is a letter of better things, because it tells us that whatever great things God did in the past, they were only preparations for something even more wonderful to come. And the third thing then is that through the coming of Christ, the problem of sin was confronted once and for all. The Old Testament sacrifices could do so much. They could take you some of the way. They could spare the wrath of God from descending upon you when you lived in those times. And you get the story, for example, on the Passover and the way in which the surrounding nation of Egypt was devastated, but the people of God were protected. And of course, that was a great event. And it really happened. It wasn't just a myth. It wasn't a story. It really happened. But it wasn't, of course, the end of the story, was it? It was a preparation for Christ, our Passover, would one day be sacrificed. And that's the way Jesus viewed his own death, wasn't it? It happened at the time of the Passover. And that's because only God could deal with sin, which is our arch enemy. Only Christ himself was qualified to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And that's really what this letter is moving towards. So really chapters 9 and 10 particularly spell out how Christ's sacrifice was the complete and final answer. You don't need to go back to the temple or the tabernacle. You don't need to kill animals anymore. Those things were just a picture of a greater sacrifice. And now that that sacrifice has been made, what happens? The way is open. So the temple curtain was split from top to bottom, a sign that God has dealt with sin, and now men and women, boys and girls can enter into God's presence through Christ. In fact, he is, there's a song we sometimes sing about gone through the curtain. I can't remember the exact words, but that's a good way of putting it. Christ has gone through into the holy place now to appear in the presence of God for us. That's the way it's put in this letter. And that brings me fourthly to remind you that those who receive this provision by faith will also share the identity or the experience of being outsiders. That's why he writes, doesn't he? Let us go outside the camp, bearing his reproach, or sharing his, how does he put it, sharing the reproach he endured. There will be times when you feel an outsider. It can even be with your own family. If you have family members who are decidedly not Christians, you will feel that to be a very painful thing at times. You'll feel it because you see what they need, and they don't, and often they don't even want to. And you'll feel at times that even in your own family circle, you don't quite fit. Let alone in the workplace, where most of your colleagues haven't any time for God whatsoever. They don't even believe he exists, or if he does, he doesn't matter. And that impacts Christians. People feel it when they apply for a new job, and they're up against all this kind of cultural wokeness, you know, which says, we can't have anybody with religious views in our camp because that might upset somebody and all the rest of it. So there's that kind of element to it as well. And then just the language and just the values, the entertainment culture, which most people, they lap it up, or if they don't actually lap it up, they put up with it without blinking and batting an eyelid. And you will feel uncomfortable with a lot of it. There are TV programs, which, particularly comedy programs, which are quite clever and could be quite entertaining, but you can't watch them because of the blasphemy and the obscenity. Because the arts are a mixed bag, aren't they? So there are lots of ways in which Christians are outsiders. And it's not because we are that weird. I know we're a bit weird. You know, churches can be very funny places. And that's often nothing to do with the actual Christianity. That's just to do with who we are and the kind of things we've inherited and so on. And we do need to be constantly trying to adapt ourselves so we don't make it more difficult than it needs to be for people to come among us. We need to be culturally sensitive, but not culturally compromised. And that's really hard, isn't it? And Christians tend to be very critical of each other and a bit defensive because of that. Often churches, you know, they try something new and the church down the road says, they've got a bit weird, you know, they've got a bit, you know, they're a bit slack because they did that or the other. It's not their business. We're all struggling to try and be relevant Christians, aren't we? And yet faithful Christians. And it's a difficult balance, isn't it? But to come back to the point, we live in a culture and in a world the postmodern world, as they call it, which normalizes and celebrates sin. And we may feel more and more like Lot. There's a passage in 2 Peter chapter 2, perhaps just as we close and could refer to that. It's a strange... 2 Peter's a strange letter. It's a bit scary, really, reading this letter, because there's a lot about judgment in it. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 7. It says, well, I'll read from verse 6. It's talking about judgment. It's never an easy subject to speak on. And it talks about the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, which were turned to ashes, condemned to extinction, making them an example of what would happen to the ungodly. And if he rescued righteous Lot, who was greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormented in his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. It says in the AV, vexed by the filthy conversation of the wicked. It's one of those verses that sticks in your mind, isn't it? Vexed. We will feel vexed at times by what's going on around us. Vexed is an interesting word. It's not just angry, it's kind of internally disturbed as well. And we do feel that, don't we? We hear stuff on the news which we know is out of order, not good for people, and yet it's marketed as if it's the best thing since sliced bread, particularly to do with gender issues and so on. And that reminds us that our true identity and our destiny are beyond this world. We'll never quite fit. We'll always be somewhat of an outsider in this world. And that's why this passage finishes. Here we have no continuing city, but we seek one that is to come. We look forward to the new heavens and the new earth. We look forward to Christ's return. We look forward to the King being on his throne and acknowledged 100% by everybody who's there, not just a few like here tonight, but by everybody in that city, the redeemed of the Lord gathered together, the elect of God, finally and fully gathered in to sing his praise forever, acknowledging him, as Steve was saying this morning, in his greatness. He talked a lot about the greatness of God, didn't he, this morning? And that was a good thing to hear. But God is great, and he's greater than all that the world can throw in his face. We saw that from Psalm 2 recently with Tom, didn't we? And he will have the last word. So, though we're outsiders, that is not the whole story. We seek a city which is to come, and it is to come. And we have a place, and we'll be there, simply by faith, in all that Jesus has done, and all that God has promised to us. And we have the great tangible reminder of that in our communion, which we're going to share together now.